You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Hello and welcome to Truth Without Radio. Today's date is the 13th of May 2016. It's Friday the 13th. Unlucky for some, unlucky for bankers and Freemasons and Templars, that is. Because Friday the 13th, Jacques de Molay was, and all the other Templars were rounded up because of their usurious and occult activities they were involved in. So that's the real reason why Friday the 13th is considered unlucky. So it should actually be lucky for us, because we were the ones that were paying, paying through the nose to these Templar bankers. But as always, today I'm joined by my two co-hosts, Mr. Dennis Wise and Mr. Schmidt. Dennis, how are you doing today?
Don't call me anything, but don't call me lucky. Okay. Wait, I didn't know this would be a useless information for you. I didn't know that airfares on Friday the 13th could be down to as much as 46% because people are frightened to fly.
Wow. So that's when you want to buy tickets then.
Well, it's thanks to the Templars, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, that's what it goes back to. That's what I've heard. I mean, there's nothing else. I don't think that bad luck that actually happened on Friday the 13th. There's no other reason for it. Schmidt, how are you doing today?
I'm quite well, thanks. I had no idea that today was Friday the 13th. But I don't feel particularly unlucky today, even now that I know. So, yeah, I think it's going to be a good show.
Yeah, I only just remembered, just looking at the calendar then, I knew as I was planning out the week's radio that it was Friday the 13th. But, this is the first time I've actually sort of looked at the date today. I just remembered that. It's interesting, isn't it, the way that we're told that it's unlucky, but the bad luck actually fell on these Templar bankers. So really, it's unlucky for bankers. But today, as always, I think we're going to start off with your presentation, Schmidt. I believe it's on Dönitz this week. Admiral Dönitz, is that right?
Yes, absolutely. Karl Dönitz, the last German head of state, the last legal German head of state, as now we have occupied Germany and not proper Germany. So, yeah, Karl Dönitz, he was born in 1891 in Grünau, near Berlin. At the age of 18, he joined the Imperial German Navy. He went through infantry, artillery, and torpedo training and graduated from officer school. At the beginning of the First World War, he was serving on a small cruiser, the SMS Breslau, which was sold to the Ottoman Empire, which was at that time allied with Germany. The Breslau was then involved in battles against Russian naval forces in the Black Sea. He earned himself the Iron Cross second class and also received Ottoman decorations for his achievements there. In 1916, he volunteered for service on submarines. After the necessary training, he served on several U-boats and earned himself the Iron Cross first class this time. And in September of 1918, he was granted command of one. That U-boat was sunk in the Mediterranean by British naval units, however, but most of the crews survived and were taken prisoners. After the war had ended and Dönitz had been released from captivity, he went back to Germany and started to develop theories and tactics. Theories on tactics and strategies for submarine warfare. In the interwar years, he worked his way up in the German Navy. He commanded torpedo boats, a corvette, a frigate, and then in 1934, as captain of the cruiser Emden, he spent several months in Southeast Asia. After returning, General Admiral Raeder tasked him with the creation of the submarine fleet. This had become possible because Adolf Hitler had freed Germany from the chains of the Treaty of Versailles in the same year. In 1939, he was appointed Commodore. 1 month after the beginning of the Second World War, he was promoted to Rear Admiral and served as Befehlshaber der Unterseeboote, or Commander of the Submarines. He immediately began to put the theories he had developed into practice. One of these was the doctrine to have one-third of the submarines in the combat zones, one-third moving either from the combat zones to safe harbors, or the other way around, and one-third undergoing maintenance, repairs, refueling, etc. Another one that he came up with was what he called the Rudeltaktik, which called for a submarine that had spotted an enemy convoy to radio the position and course of that target to the headquarters via the Enigma cipher machine, without attacking. It was to wait until more submarines had joined and then to attack together, in a pack, as it were. The first time this tactic was used was on the 5th of October 1940, and it resulted in devastating losses for the Allies. Five German U-boats under the command of Otto Kretschmer, also known as Silent Otto, the most successful submarine commander of all times, attacked an Allied convoy consisting of 35 ships, and 20 of these were sunk in one night, causing the loss of 80,000 tons of supplies to the Allies. He also recommended that the submarines attack on the surface because of better accuracy, and they are faster to outrun a convoy or to catch up with it. In March of 1942, Dönitz was promoted and appointed to the rank of admiral. And in early 1943, he succeeded Erich Räder as Grand Admiral. There's a long list of his decorations and awards, both from the First and the Second World War, but to mention only a few. The Knight's Cross to the Iron Cross with oak leaves, a special version of the U-boat war badge with diamonds, made exclusively for him. He was the only one to ever wear it. The Military Order of Savoy, given to him by Italy, the Military Order of Michael the Brave from Romania. And towards the end of the war, on the 21st of January 1945, Dönitz launched Operation Hannibal, which had the aim of evacuating as many Germans as possible from the advancing, raping and murdering Bolsheviks. Using all available war, passenger and transport ships, they managed to save almost 2 million men, women and children. This was the largest evacuation operation in history. The Soviets torpedoed many of these refugee ships, causing tens of thousands to die. One of these ships was the Wilhelm Gustloff. Over 9,000 Germans perished. Over 5,000 of these children and thousands of women, elderly and wounded. This was the largest catastrophe at sea in recorded history. Everybody knows about the Titanic, but how many have ever even heard of the Wilhelm Gustloff? After he had done as much as possible to save as many Germans as possible, Dönitz on the 7th of May authorized Alfred Jodl, the chief of staff of the OKW, to sign the surrender documents, which specified that all German military forces had to cease operations at 11 p.m. on the 8th of May. The Allies had threatened to resume the terror bombing of German cities otherwise. Dönitz continued to act as the legitimate head of the German Reich until, in violation of international law, he and other members of the government were arrested by British soldiers. This meant the de facto dissolution of the last legitimate German government. And the last two times you have heard how he became head of state after Adolf Hitler's death. So after the war, they imprisoned Dönitz for 10 years in the Spandau prison in Berlin. He was accused of, again, we know the story of war crimes, but they had no actual evidence of that, but they still condemned him to 10 years in prison. He lived quite a quiet life until his death after he was released from prison. He died at the age of 89 in the year 1980. He was buried at the Waldfriedhof Cemetery in Aumühle, where he had lived. The administration of occupied Western Germany forbade that he could be buried with military honors. Soldiers were not allowed to wear uniforms to the funeral. In spite of this, a number of German naval officers disobeyed this order and were joined by members of the Royal Navy in full dress uniform. Over 5,000 people attended, among them over 100 Knight's Cross holders, including Hans Ulrich Rudel. Yes, that was it. My biography of Dönitz.
That's but when you say there that the members of the Royal Navy went to his funeral, was that the British Royal Navy?
Yes, it is. That's how it is reported.
That's good. That's promising to see.
He actually received quite a lot of letters of admiration from Allied naval soldiers and officers.
Well, I bet he did with all those medals that he'd won, and being the submarine commander and having a medal just made up especially for himself. What was the? Do you know what the Romanian one was for? Why the Romanians were giving him a medal?
No, I think this just had to do with the war effort in general. I remember quite a few Germans receiving foreign decorations, but I don't know if this was for a specific sea battle or anything like that. As Romania is landlocked, I don't think they had much to do with naval warfare in the Second World War.
Well, that's what I was thinking.
But yeah.
That's what I was thinking. They must have been really grateful for something. And where was it that they were rescuing the German refugees from? Where was it they were rescuing them from and taking them to?
Well, that was because Eastern Prussia was already almost completely blocked by the Red Army, and they had to evacuate as many as they could by sea then. That's why they were using all these transport and warships and passenger ships, everything they could get hold of. And the Wilhelm Gustloff, the passenger ship that was sunk by a Soviet submarine, was actually used to be a Kraft durch Freude ship. It was used to enable holidays for the average German worker, where they would sail to Italy, for example, to go on holiday with a greatly subsidized fare for low-income workers.
Yeah, so that the workers could travel and see a bit of the world. They actually prevented any of those ships from docking in Britain because they didn't want the British workers to see how well treated the German workers were. See what a success the National Socialist government was over there and how well they treated their workers. And you would think that would be held up as a war crime. You know, shooting a defenseless ship that's just taking refugees. And we're told we're not allowed to shoot these. We're not allowed to shoot these ships full of invaders coming over from Africa. We've got to go out there and rescue them. Yet when it's Germans that are on board a ship, hundreds of them, thousands of them, as you say, oh, it's perfectly fine to shoot them, and we just forget about that. You know, that's a really down and dirty thing to do, isn't it? Just shoot a defenseless ship full of refugees. I had heard of the Wilhelm Gustloff. But I didn't know that many details about it. I didn't know that Dönitz was involved with that. I thought at the time he was sort of taking over from Adolf Hitler. I didn't realize he was personally involved in that. Dennis, have you got anything you'd like to say about that presentation from Schmidt there?
Yeah, well, I knew obviously about the sinking. I mean, really surprised me, like, because I know the Russians. And the Soviets, rather, didn't care much about the Geneva Convention. And Dönitz was a highly honourable person, who obviously even some of the British knew. But he got treated badly, like I think I mentioned before, at the end of the war, you know, when they come to the meeting, they refused to shake hands with him and made it plainly obvious that he wasn't just a surrendering officer, he was a prisoner of war and will be treated as such, which is totally opposite of how the Germans treated the French, if you remember, on the train coach. You know, they give them all the respect required to an enemy, a defeated enemy. Just a totally different world to how the Allies treated the Germans.
They were given full honours, weren't they? They were given full honours, the French were. I just got somebody in the chat room who was saying Romania has beaches on the Black Sea. So maybe there was some naval warfare in the Black Sea. And that might have been the reasoning for that medal. I was just thinking there, they accused him of war crimes, but nothing in specific then. Just war crimes. You were a Nazi, so we'll charge you with war crimes. They couldn't actually think of anything that he actually did.
They did call it unrestricted naval warfare because they attacked transport ships, but the Allies did the same. So there's no real logical or compelling reason for why he should be on trial for anything. And as I said, a lot of British and, in fact, Allied Navy people expressed their admiration for Dönitz and for the way he conducted the war from his side, from the naval perspective.
He was in the same prison as Rudolf Hess, somebody else that was just in prison for no reason, imprisoned for the whole of his life. I mean, Rudolf Hess was just on a peace mission, trying to bring a peace about with offers of peace. To put someone in prison who's on a peace mission and keep him locked up for the rest of his life, you would think that Amnesty International would get involved in that, that they would be saying, look at this injustice. This man died in prison after going on a peace mission. But no, nothing about that. There was a memorial put up for Rudolf Hess and the left went and smashed it to pieces. They desecrated it. And the police have done nothing about it since. In fact, there was an ITV film crew that went there along with the vandals to film them desecrating the war memorial, and nothing's been done about it. They've never been charged with desecrating a war memorial. And yet this honourable man, really honourable man, risks his life to parachute in behind enemy lines with an offer of peace to try and stop the war. And look at what they did to him. It's disgusting. Yeah, and he was kept in solitary confinement as well, wasn't he?
Yeah, he was kept in solitary confinement, and then a week or so before his expected release, after so long in prison and such an old age, they said he committed suicide, which is ridiculous because, I mean, he's going to meet his family shortly, you know.
I've read a bit about the death of Hess, and it seems absolutely clear that he was murdered. I don't remember the details right now, but it had something to do with the strangulation. It doesn't seem possible that he could have done it himself, aside from all the other reasons. Why should he do that when he was all these decades in prison and he was about to be released? And I think from what I remember, it was the Soviets that didn't mind his release anymore, at least one of the Allied superpowers, it were. And someone, I think, must have been really afraid what he could say about what he experienced at the time in Germany.
Well, it would have to be, wouldn't it?
So one of the main reasons for the solitary confinement and then, yeah, not releasing him.
And what other reason could there be? I mean, the guy was there trying to bring about a peace. You would think that they would keep him as a prisoner of war until the end of the war and then release him. What possible legal standing could they have had? And that's
well,
a real opium.
For years, right? I think the whole prison was empty. It wasn't just a cell, it was the whole prison. He was the only one in there, I think.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's true. Towards the end, he was the only one, yeah.
I mean, that's a real open flouting of the law, isn't it? I mean, that's just totally breaking the law. And, you know, I mean, there can't be any legal standing for that whatsoever. Just an open flouting of international law, and nobody publicises it. Nobody talks about it. Mm. I mean, that should be proof enough to anyone that's not on our side that, you know, there was something iffy with the war, if you tell them about that. and with Amnesty International and all these other groups? You know, why haven't they made a fuss about it?
Amnesty International actually is funded by one of the Rockefeller foundations. So there you go.
Well, yeah, we know that. We know Amnesty International is more like Amnesia International. But, you know, the leftists, the average person thinks that Amnesty International are a good group of people that stand up for political prisoners of conscience. Yeah, you know, there you go. There you've got somebody who tried to stop a war, the World War, risked his life to do that, and his reward was to be in prison for the rest of his life. So it's obvious that he knew something that they couldn't risk getting out at all. Solitary confinement for the rest of his life. That's shocking. And after that, then, so when they arrested Donetsk, and then they just put in an occupational government, didn't they? They got rid of all the leading people and put in their own as an occupational government, occupying the area, and it's been the same ever since, hasn't it?
Correct.
Yes, they don't even have a proper constitution. What they have is the Grundgesetz, which was forced upon them by the Allies. And ever since then, there has been no German constitution written, no post-war German constitution.
I covered that in the documentary. There's actually that document, but there was one written by an East German officer. He revealed that there's another one signed previous to that behind closed doors, which gave the rights to the West, to all publishers and all media outlets right up to the end of the century.
The right to make the laws and tell them, you know, what they're supposed to be doing. This is why Merkel is allied against the German people, is because she's not of the German people. She's working for the UN. She's working for a group of people that were prosecuting a war against Germany. And that never stopped prosecuting that war. It never came to an end. It's like Russia with Japan. Russia is still fighting against Japan on paper. It was on the news the other day that Putin was going over there to meet the Japanese president, but the war had never actually ended, and Russia is still at war with Japan. Of course, they'll never tell you that the Allies and Britain and France are all still at war with Germany. In fact, France had come to a peace agreement with Germany. So it was terrorists that were fighting against Germany from France because there was an armistice. We've had an armistice in Ireland, yet we don't call the terrorists over there. We don't call them freedom fighters. No, we don't call them the Irish resistance like the French resistance, like we do romanticize the French terrorists after they'd come to a peace agreement with Germany. All these things that we're told about war, these agreements and armistices and surrenderings, all of that went out the window in the Second World War. All of it.
Correct.
It definitely warrants further investigation, I say. You've been investigating some new subjects this week as well, Dennis, I hear. Do you want to go into some of what you've been looking into for the next part of Communism by the Back Door?
Yeah, well, I was hoping to get it finished for this week. I put a lot of hours on it over the last few days, day and night, practically. But finally realised, you know, you can't rush it, you know. But it is probably one of the most powerful videos that I've done, actually. I certainly opened my eyes on a few things as well. The difficulty, technical side, what was difficult was the fact that it's usually always a problem, but more so in this case because of the actual quality of footage that I managed to find wasn't always that great, and so I've had to spend time trying to make it a lot better. I mean, I think I used about 7 or 8 different YouTube videos to put it all together, and obviously you get different levels of sound and trebles and bass, etc. So that was the problem in itself. But like I said, the footage that I found, it all stems from this from Bill Cooper's work. He talks about the Warsaw Pact, for instance, which was supposed to be a Russian gathering of all the East German countries, all the communist countries there, because obviously the United Nations were forming the West. So it was supposed to be like an answer to all that, when in fact the answer to the same Security Council as what the Western powers did. And this is why we had the Cold War, and being a sham, and this is why, you know, there was never any actually, any fighting. And in that whole period of about, I think it's about 41, 43 years, something like that, it cost the American taxpayer $5 trillion. And certainly cost the Russians as well eventually. So, that was interesting. There was a piece in there as well when I managed to find about Churchill, who actually launched the Cold War with a speech, his famous speech about how he condemned the communists taking over Europe now and putting it into a state of terror. Of course, forgetting that him and Roosevelt had met at Yalta and handed over Eastern Europe to Stalin on a silver platter. And not one criticism around the world, neither from any of the media, when he made that speech. Well, more or less launched the Cold War, and from then on, like it was a reason to keep armaments going and taxes high, etc., all for this fake Cold War. So that's in the episode. Another part as well, like which has always confused me, because I've always looked down on Freemasonry, was the fact that the Founding Fathers were Freemasons, and yet they came out with this independence contract. So I looked into that, and like he explains that as well. He kind of says like that the French Revolution and the American Revolution were actually for the basis to form, for countries to form other governments to actually, in time, deport all the kings and queens around Europe, which eventually that did happen. Because of the lack of freedom in Europe, these founding fathers had gone to America to look for the new world, and apparently they'd always intended on creating a new world. So when they got to America, like after the War of Independence with Britain, they came up with a charter, which kind of gave people freedom for the first time ever. I don't think the Romans in their democracy, so to speak, I think they could do whatever they wanted if they felt like it. So there weren't really no real freedom there, and I can't think of anywhere else. So for the first time, people in America had this sense of freedom. But the problem was that the Founding Fathers also had a system where if that was abused, or whether they failed, which they probably thought they would do because human beings are what they are, they had a backup system. And I looked into that, and that was quite interesting. You know, the fact is that when you're actually born in America, you're actually born a U.S. sovereign, and that means you get all the rights in all the 50 states of what the Charter of Independence gave you. But if by chance you decide to claim benefits, or a couple of other means as well, you're then classed as a U.S. citizen, and by that, kind of forfeit all your freedom. And this is particularly what's happening today, apparently. Not a lot of people in America actually know this, I don't think, but, you know, it's a similar system to what is over here, where all our rights are taken straight at birth with signing of the registry, the birth registry. You're stripped of all your normal rights and given these, what they call privileges. And that's the same in America, you get privileges. These benefits can be taken away, which is exactly what Cameron's doing over here at the moment. Taking the benefit away from people quite legally. So, and that's an interesting slot in this video. But another one especially was, which surprised me, was the Waco Massacre. Now, after working on, you know, the last week or so on this video, I now get the sense, how deep the problem is for the, for Obama and the rest of them to get these guns, because it literally is, as close as I can get to it is to saw somebody's arm off. That's how strongly Americans feel about these gun laws, which is hard to comprehend over in the UK and in Europe because we never had that luxury. But over there, it's so embedded in them. I suppose it comes from the Wild West. But the fact is, if you want to take the guns off a lot of these Americans, there's a few million of these people as well, they will put up a fight. And as a poster I saw said, I'm prepared to die to keep my gun, are you prepared to die to take it. And that is the line in the sand to an awful lot of people out there. And this is why Obama is really struggling. And this come to a head with me when I was looking at the Waco footage back there in the 90s when Clinton was president. Now, I always thought, as most people did, that Koresh was this lunatic fringe cult leader who somehow ended up in a battle with the FBI and the whole place burnt down and his followers, 80 followers at least, and some women and a lot of women and children were killed in that battle. Like most people, I just brushed it off. But then when I looked into it, it was the whole core, it was right to the soul of these gun laws in America. And what had happened is that the FBI found out they had a certain amount of guns, which it still wasn't breaking the law, but instead of coming in and, you know, either arresting him when he went to Walmart or when he was out jogging, which he did every morning, they came in force, kicked down his doors and et cetera. And he, as an American, was only, you know, backing up his own rights. There's a piece where I managed to find on the internet, and it's because he managed to smuggle some tapes out, and the FBI got hold of these tapes, wouldn't release them because they felt that by the American audience listening to him, they would feel some sympathy for him. And I've no doubt they were quite right, because he was actually saying, look, you know, I've got my rights. If you want to come round to the place with your two helicopters, your tanks, and, you know, a whole host of, you know, machine guns, I'm going to stand at that door and you're going to feel it. And that's exactly what happened when you look at it. As soon as the FBI stormed the place, they were backed off with a lot of killing. Now, in another tape where he released, he said, look, you know, he didn't want to kill anybody, but he's got his rights. And if, you know, if the case may be, then, you know, God's going to judge me. So it was coming from this very soul of the American gun law. And what frightens me, there's a lot of people in America just like him. I know for a fact. And Bill Cooper was one as well, because at the end of this particular episode, I cover the fact that he also got killed by the government. So and he was one of these leading keep the gun campaigners. So fascinating revision I've done, and I'm trying to put it into this extra powerful video. The music, I think, is perfect. That's if YouTube don't ban it. But like I said, you know, rather than rush it, I just felt, you know, maybe sometime next week.
Oh, yeah, it's much better to work on it and make sure that you've got it absolutely perfect before it comes out. You don't want to be revising it once it's been released. I mean, there's a few things that strike me about that. I mean, with the gun laws, I mean, the Americans still understand that if you need to be able to defend yourself, because you haven't got police everywhere. In Britain, we're told, oh, well, we've got the police to prevent crimes. And people think the police are there to stop crime, but they're not. The police are there to arrest people after a crime has been committed. So in America, if you see a crime being committed and you've got a gun, you can defend yourself. You can stop that crime from happening. Whereas we can't do that over here. And the second point with the guns is that if ever there was a tyranny and the government was taken over by a tyranny, then the people would have the weapons, the necessary weapons, to defend themselves against that tyranny. And really, if you trust your people, if you trust your citizens, then they should all have weapons, because they should be ready to defend the country from an invasion. That's the really important Correct. Thing. I mean, that's what the Swiss have. The Swiss all still have a gun at home in the house. They have to protect themselves from invasion, because they still trust their people. And I think the more multicultural a nation becomes, the less trust there is of the people, and the less the people can actually trust the government. And to go back to what you were saying about the Declaration of Independence and making the people citizens in the free world, I think what they actually did when they did away with slavery, what they did, they gave the slaves names and records, but they also then took names and records of all the white people. So everyone, in effect, became a slave of the state. Whereas before that, you had the blacks that were the property of the free men. that once the slaves had been freed, you essentially, you got everybody was seen as the same. They were all just a name or a number, an economic unit. And that actual Declaration of Independence, where it says, we hold these truths to be, all these truths to be equal and true. And it says that, all men are equal. Well, it can only mean by that all white men are equal. And the reason why they thought all white men are equal is because they had blacks around them. If you were in Europe and you just had white people, there's no way you would say all white people are equal, because they're not. You have all these different European nations. They're all different. French are different from Germans. Germans are different from English. English are different from Spanish. But if you are living with blacks around you, if you are compared to the blacks, then yes, all the white men are equal when compared to the Negro. And it was that actually inspired the Declaration of Independence. If they hadn't have actually had those Negroes living among them, they never would have said all men are equal. And when they said all men are equal, they meant all white men. Because a white man and a black man are not equal. It's obvious that they're not equal just from looking at them. But if you're comparing one race to the other race, then you can say that one of those races are equal. And I agree with you there about the founding fathers. And even though they were Freemasons, some of them were good people. There have been a lot of good people that got involved in Freemasonry, because Freemasonry does claim to have these lofty ideals, and people get taken in by it. A lot of people get taken in by it. But it gets used as like a secret service almost. It gets used for undermining nations and putting their people in charge. It gets used to cover up for pedophiles. And you get criminal conspiracies going on in there, and with everybody backing each other up. And that's the evil, wicked side of it, and the Antichrist side of it. But then on the other side of it, you've got these people that give money to the orphans and the widows and are involved in these charitable organizations. So those that are on the outside of it, or the Blue Lodge Masons, a lot of them could be quite good. And you can even get people higher up that don't know about all of this that goes on, because you've got to have some decent people involved in order to cover up for the wicked people, haven't you?
I just find a problem in a country of having a secret society, because a secret society is what it is. It's a secret society, and they hide secrets. And the only secrets you're going to hide is secrets you don't want other people to hear. So when I see my government complicit with these secret societies, I look at them all with the same brush, you know what I mean? Like, and tear them with the same brush.
Well, in Greece, in democratic Greece, you weren't allowed to have a meeting inside your home because you were talking about something that the rest of the people weren't hearing about. So it must be something that's not good for the nation, because you're keeping it from everybody else. If you wanted to meet and have a discussion, it had to be in the public sphere, so that everybody could hear. Because otherwise you could have been plotting to try and get one over on the rest. You could have been plotting to all put your prices up on a certain piece of merchandise, which would then mean that you were making more than you should be out of your society. Now, things used to be a lot more equal back then than today with our fake equality that we try to promote. Back then, when you had a homogenous nation, you did have a type of equality, because they knew that you can't take from one part of the nation without another part suffering. You know, you can't make yourself rich at the expense of the others, because it's a no-win game, because it's part of your nation that you're using to make yourself rich. But as soon as you import another group into your nation, then they are quite happy to do that, because they are quite happy to take as much as they can from you, because they're not taking from themselves, are they? Which is why we've been encouraged to do this by these Jews. That's at the root of all these human rights. It's your human right to make as much profit as you can from your community. That's the human right.
The other part, by the way, is I had this discussion with Messerschmitt last week. I was saying, you know, I have to think, because I don't give myself easy tasks, then, as you know. I mean, you know, to try and make Adolf Hitler look good to a lot of people were a major task, and I've had one or two others, but I've never dodged any of the issues. I've always tried to put them in videos and explain, especially with the Hollywood thing that was quite difficult, and the music business, because there's not a lot of freely available stuff to work with, but I managed it, and people seemed quite happy and content with them. But this was the Alien thing, which we got onto last week, and that's a difficult one again because of the stigma around it. But I think I've managed it again. I'd be surprised if I get criticised for it. I actually have because what the situation was that for a long period of time, Bill Cooper actually saw these documents and papers and did believe them. But at the very end, he came to the conclusion that there was no evidence at all about these aliens, but there was a ton of evidence of people trying to persuade people and wanting people to believe there was an alien society which could invade any time, just to get everybody thinking in a one world, one government mindset. This is what he came down to. And I don't think he's far wrong, because he mentioned that Reagan, in a few of his speeches, brought up the subject quite often. And I have got footage of Reagan at the United Nations talking about the aliens. I've also got one of the guys who walks on the moon who believes in aliens. And so the little piece I put together with the footage what I managed to find, to me, comes over pretty well. I was quite happy with it. I'm sure Messerschmitt is happy to hear that.
You still there, Messerschmitt? He must have gone.
Yes, sorry, had my microphone muted. Yes, I heard.
Adopted. I thought aliens had got it there for Messerschmitt. Yeah, but I managed to do it, yeah. So, well, I think I have anyway. And if I think I have, I probably have.
Yeah, you just make yourself an easy target if you talk about aliens in any serious context. But I'm glad to hear you managed to sail around that a bit.
Yeah, well, the thing is, you've got to confront these things. I mean, even in the Adolf Hitler video, there were certain things what people, even who admire Hitler, won't go down that road, because they know, there's a lot of things being said about it which people believe, and they try and steer away from that subject. But in the documentary, to get a truthful documentary in that 6 hours, what I did, I had to face every problem, and I'm pretty sure I did do. The only problem maybe I didn't face was the SA, the assassinations of the leaders in the SA, it came to a point. But it always amuses me when people of the other side want to know about Nazi infighting, because they've got nothing else to go on. But I mean, it'd been that well documented that I didn't even go there, because I had enough on with 6 hours of fresh stuff. So I was quite happy.
I think, that you're quite right there in saying that there was this idea of promoting the aliens to then bring the people together into the New World Order. Because if you're being attacked by an enemy, like we're being attacked by these terrorists today, they try to form a coalition against it. And if they could say, there's aliens that have attacked, we need a coalition against it, they could then advance the cause of internationalism. It's like when they say our climate is being damaged, we must have an international coalition against it. So they could have used something like that. And it did seem as if they were trying to promote the idea. I mean, putting War of the Worlds on the radio, as if it was really happening, leaking these things that were happening in Area 51, and deliberately having these sightings of unidentified flying objects and making out, an unidentified flying object, it must be a UFO. Well, no, it's just an unidentified flying object. It could be a bird. You just don't know what it is. So yeah, I can believe that's what they were doing. I do think it's crazy to talk about it seriously. I mean, it just does make nationalists look daft, really. A lot of the conspiracy stuff, I think, is deliberately encouraged to try and make people look silly. I mean, there's not just that one. There are other ones that people can go into. I won't go into them here, but it just does make us look silly to talk about these way out theories. There's no evidence for.
When you see your president of the United States talking about them, it kind of levels the playing field, if you know what I'm trying to say. And actually, I did find some what was reportedly to be leaked Russian footage of aliens, which I put in there, so it's for you to decide, you know what I'm saying? I don't believe it myself, though. Don't be thinking I do. What I'm trying to say is, I think there has been some kind of conspiracy to create this atmosphere of a possible invasion, or they're already here among us, and we need to all gel together as one. That's where I think they're all coming from.
Well, if they can make us believe that 6 million Jews were gassed in gas chambers, then I'm fairly sure they could make us believe in aliens if they wanted. But there'd still be a group of people that refuse to believe it.
Yeah, I know what you're saying. I mean, you know, some people want to believe some things. You know, they're looking for something to believe in. And, well, like I said, I'm quite happy with how that little piece came out. So next week we'll find out.
Interesting about Churchill when you bring him up as well. You're talking about the Cold War. If it wasn't for Churchill, then there wouldn't have been a Soviet Union in the first place. Yet nobody pointed that out, that it was thanks to Churchill and Roosevelt that we had the Soviet Union and we had the Cold War. And another interesting thing that's been pointed out recently about this Cold War was that none of the leaders of the Soviet Union were ever demonized as much as Putin has been.
You know, no, it's true.
None of them.
None of them. Gorbachev were welcomed. Even Thatcher were welcomed.
Well, they were involved in it, weren't they? Especially the South African communists and the African communists. I mean, you did a lot of work on that as well, didn't you, Dennis? Showing the links with Margaret Thatcher and these communists over there in South Africa. That was back in...
Mandela, all Freemasons, Freemasons.
What was that Freemasonic link as well? The blacks are really attracted to Freemasonry as well, with all the names and the prestige that it gives to them and the secret societies. You know, they became very interested in that and very involved in that, I believe, after they became freed slaves in America. Freemasonry, you know, it used to have quite a lot more of a respectable face to it than it does now. But it was at the source of all these revolutions. I mean, that still today, the French motto, what is it, fraternity, liberty, egality, that's the motto of the Freemasons.
Exactly, yeah. Well, I mean, France, I've always felt that France, Britain, America were Masonic, even years ago, even before I did any research. I felt that, you know, they weren't the religious countries that people thought they were, but they were Masonic as a religion. And then when you think about it, once they funded the revolution in Russia, they're now controlling the eastern side of Europe and they're controlling the western side of Europe. So when you get a country like Germany and a couple of others in there deciding enough is enough, they have got them completely surrounded, and they've got the Bolsheviks on one side of Europe using them as the bad guys, and then the West going in there, you know, to take down Hitler. But then we've got to hold these bad guys back as well, you know, when really they're all on the same side fighting Germany. And even the Americans, and Bill Cooper is one of them, and Eustace Mullins is another one. They all miss the Hitler thing. They can't see that the same people who are running down America today, stripping it of everything it's got, they're running really, I mean, Israel, they're giving Israel so many millions a day, and the country's struggling. And yet they can't see that the same people. Hitler got rid of these when he took over Germany. And in 3 years, I mean, the 25 demands of National Socialism was a charter that they drew up. And at the end, it says something on the lines of that each leader of the party will, until death, strive to make these demands successful, which they did. Obviously, I mean, you know, it was a powerhouse in 3-4 years.
Well, this is the thing that the main point that the conspiracy theorists and the left miss out on. You've got the left that are against capitalism and say they're against the banks, they're against Israel, they're against Zionism, they're against what's going on in Palestine, and yet they think Hitler was this demon who gassed 6 million Jews and have no idea of what really went on there. And then you've got the conspiracy crowd who also will make out that Hitler was the most evil man alive, and anything evil has to be likened to Hitler or the Nazis. And yet, if they were only to actually look into this, they would find that actually it was the National Socialists that fought against this, and they should actually be coming to the side of the Nationalists. They should be coming to our side. If they really want social justice, then you can only have that if you have an ethnic nation. You can only have real justice and real social programs if it's within one single ethnic nation. If you have other groups in there, then one is going to be the slave and the other is going to be the master, which is what we have now. We're giving out our social programs that should be for our people are being given to the quote-unquote refugees and the invaders. So they are the masters and we are the slaves. They've done nothing to work to put into those social programs. They have no social programs in their own country, and yet we're being forced to pay for them, give them access to our healthcare, our schools, putting a roof over their heads, and they've never managed to do any of that for themselves in their own country. And yet, again, this goes back to the Human Rights Act and saying that everybody is equal. When the Declaration of Independence, that everybody is equal, is based upon, cannot possibly have meant blacks to be equal to whites. It just not possible, because we're not equal. We're obviously not equal. If you look at the works that were produced at the time, they even said that. You know, there were books at the time that were written explaining why the Declaration of Independence came about, why that line came out, and that's the reason why it came out. Because when Negroes are living among the white man is all equal. Take the Negro away, and the white man is not equal. You've got different types of white man. It's only when contrasted with the Negro that the white man is equal. And, of course, the Negro is called the Negro. So when it says all men are equal, if it meant Negroes as well, it would have said all men and Negroes, because Negroes were considered a different thing. Did you have something you wanted to play for us, Dennis? You were talking about.
Well, can I just say, just before I forget, the problem that the militias have as well in America is, I noticed on YouTube, I was watching a video by one of the people over there, like, who's, you know, forms these militias in case the government do start. He said something like, we have to defend our rights and look what's happening. You know, Obama's brought out these Nazi gun laws. Well, they don't even know who their enemy is at the moment, so how the hell can they win that fight? Because the Nazis never actually took the guns off people. That was a Weimar Republic. And yet, because of the likes of Alex Jones and a number of others, people are convinced that Hitler was the one who took the guns off the Germans. But the militias over there have to realize that it isn't the Nazis, boys. It is the communists. And when you talk about New World Order, if I can play this, this is a little section what Bill said about just around the time of the Iraq War, Bush made a comment which a lot of people missed. He said, I don't know if you can hear this, and I hope so anyway. I'll just play it for you. It's only a few seconds.
George Bush said it very clearly, but nobody was listening, when he said, no longer will any nation stand against a world united. And with that action, he established the legal foundation in international law that the United Nations is now legally a one-world government.
And that's what he's saying. You know, the United Nations was the vehicle right from day one to be the vehicle to bring communism into a new world order. And when you look at the leaders of the secretaries of the United Nations, there have been one communist and six socialists. And the actual idea was thought of by Roosevelt and his right-hand man, Alger Hiss, who was actually at Yalta with Roosevelt, handing Eastern Europe over to the communists, and was later found out to be a communist spy and was actually put in court, and it was actually done on perjury. But just about everybody understood that he was a spy.
And the UN and what they come out with is what all the other groups have to abide by, even if you're not signed up to it. Like they'll try and take Bashar al-Assad and try and charge him under the UN court. The EU has to abide by the UN Court of Human Rights. America has to abide by these UN, what the UN diktats are. So the UN is this overarching group that dictates to the rest of the world what its laws should be. It has no sovereignty. It was never invested with any sovereignty through a king, never invested with sovereignty by God or by tradition or by history or anything. It was just claimed sovereignty by the bankers. You know, the banks were involved a lot with the United Nations, I believe. And I think it was to do with the Morgenthau Plan as well that Messerschmitt was talking about a while back, the same people involved with that. And the UNESCO, this UNESCO group that came up with all the races are equal, and race is just a social construct, and this is the official guidelines, or the official what's supposed to be taught, about race, the Scores, which came from UNESCO, that was headquartered in Moscow.
Yeah, and genders. How comes from UNESCO, all this transgender stuff?
It's all, it goes back to communism. As we know, communism is just Judaism for the Gentiles. It's Gentiles being slaves for the Jews, believing that, that they have control over their destiny and over their lives when in actual fact they don't. That's the whole democracy scam. That's why they wanted to get rid of democracy. I mean, that was the real reason for the French Revolution, was to get rid of the real rights that the people had and the real freedoms that the people had. They got rid of the kings and the queens, even though some of the kings and queens were bad. At least we still had good ones. And as E. Michael Jones has said, what came in after that was even worse. Capitalism came in after that. And then because we got capitalism, that's the new enemy. So what are we going to come up with to fight against capitalism? Communism. Communism will take down capitalism. So we had a system that worked for thousands of years. We had a monarchical system, which was similar to fascism. It was just that the guy that was the actual monarch was bred to be the monarch. It was a eugenics program. It was the fittest and most intelligent. So we had a system that worked, and then we tore it all down. Tore it all down on the advice of the Freemasons and the Jews. And now we're ruled by Freemasons and Jews, and we have wars all over the world, and we're being replaced. Someone suggested, Dennis, that for a new series, a third series, maybe you could do the previous White Empires and what happened to them. Maybe a program on each one.
Yeah, what does interest me is that most people don't realise is that the first slaves over in America were white slaves. That's an interest to me. So maybe they'll tie up with something like that. Because it all stems from the Europe of that time. I mean, you remember the Bow Street Runners, don't you? When you're drunk one night chasing Plymouth, then you get a whack over the head and you end up on a ship sailing to the New World, and you're not getting paid for your services anymore. So
was that the Bow Street Runners? I thought the Bow Street Runners were the forerunner of the police. But I know what you're talking about. When you get shanghaied, when you would have a drink, and if there was a penny in the bottom of the glass, that was it. They would bop you over the head and put you on the ship and send you off to the colonies. And you'd have indentured servitude. Yeah, there's been far more white slaves than there's ever been black slaves. We don't ask for reparations. All the Australians were taken over there as slaves. They don't ask for reparations. They built a country. They were able to build a first world civilization that was, you know, better in many ways than the civilization they'd left behind in Europe just in the space of about 100 years. And they were the people that were just taken off the streets. They were classed as vagabonds and paupers. They were villains, that was it. They were just villagers that had been dispossessed of their land, and they classed them as being illegal and as villains and against the law. It classed them as criminals and sent them over to Australia. But they were the people that couldn't find work. You know, they weren't educated people. And yet, look at what they were able to build. It's fantastic. You know, that really just shows to me the strength of our genes, of our white race. Just how important it is that we save our race and save our DNA, prevent it being mixed with these other races. Well, we're coming to the end of the podcast now, Dennis. I don't know if you want to tell people quickly where they can find your work before we go.
Yeah, the website for the Adolf Hitler documentary is The Greatest Story Ever Told, .tv. And hopefully next week, this next part 18, will be up on my YouTube channel of Communism by the Back Door, which is obviously Dennis Wise. So if you want to come along, drop me a line, most welcome.
Okay, well, thank you very much for another presentation, Messerschmitt. I know everybody is enjoying them. Thank you very much again, once again, Dennis, for coming on. And thank you, listeners. And do tune in again next Friday for another edition of Truth Will Out Radio.